This week I'm having a chat with Sheridan from the YouTube sailing and animal rescue channel Vet Tales Sailing Chuffed. Sheridan and a partner are sailing around Central America on an Expedition aluminium sailboat which they've recently spent 3 years refitting, and it's also the world's only water-based travelling veterinary clinic. They sail around different countries treating animals that need surgery and medication, as well as vaccinating animal populations to prevent the spread of disease in the animals and also people. If you want to support her and the animal rescue and veterinary work, you can visit her Patreon called Chuffed Adventures. The Odyssey Sailing Festival in the BVIs in December has a few cabins left where you can book to sail with people like Laura Decker, Brady and Alex from Delos, Colin and Glenn from Below Deck, as well as a bunch of other well-known sailors. Visit www.theoceancruisers.com/odyssey. But for now, enjoy the podcast with Sheridan.
So one of my friends just sent me a message actually a couple hours ago. She was like, yeah, Mediterranean is a synonym for motor every day. I was like, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah, it feels like that on the west coast of Mexico a lot of the time as well. Not so bad in the Sea of Cortez now, but like Central America, when we were heading up the coast, we motored a lot.
Oh, no way. I thought you got like trade wind. I've never sailed over there, but I thought you got trade winds around that side.
Yeah, I think certain times of the year it can be okay, but we always seem to be moving at the wrong time of the year where either the wind's on the nose or it's like non-existent.
Yeah.
We've had a fair bit of motor.
Always comes from the wrong direction.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we were having a conversation about it a couple hours ago. I think like this is a very short season for us because I literally got the boat fixed and put in the water in like August. Because I did a refit on it. Like I think next year we are just going to wait for the wind, but that might mean waiting a long time in anchorages you don't necessarily want to be in.
Yeah, for sure. We're in the Sea of Cortez now, and we've had a lot better like wind where it tends to be a bit more consistent, where it'll be like, you know, 3 days from the north and then 4 days from the south and things like that, so you can plan a little easier. But yeah, coming up the rest of the Central American and Mexican coastline was very unpredictable, and just more often than not we ended up motoring, which sucks, especially when you're beating into it. So it's nice to have some wind. Yeah,
You know, at least if you were sailing you'd be like heeled and like pushing through the waves a little bit. Yeah. But when you're motoring, no, it's a disgrace. My shaft seal leaks when I'm motoring, so I really like sailing because I don't get that filled with water. I need to replace the mounts. I think it's off. Not in the correct position because a couple of the mounts are out. So I'm getting water coming in.
Yeah, that's no good. That's stressful. Yeah.
It is. I mean, that's what bilge pumps are for. So the bilge pump can take the stress of it.
It works. We've got an aluminium boat, so anything to keep salt water out of it is like, we do not want, you know, salt water anywhere. Just starts eating it.
Have you got even if you have the bilges painted, it finds its way through the paint anyway, but like, have you got all your bilges coated now?
No. So we ended up coating the engine compartment for that exact reason. Cause like we've got a dripless, so it doesn't really drip much, but you know, every now and then you'll get a couple of drops, and And our old engine, the exhaust elbow like broke on it. And so then we got flooded with water that way. You know, there's always something. So the engine compartment's painted, but the rest is bare with the idea that at least we can see the damage instead of kind of finding out when we take paint up what's happening below it, because we did have that problem before as well.
Yeah, I just had a thought. I wonder if it's not dripless. I wonder if it's dripless.
Yeah, it might be. Maybe. drips less, sure.
Maybe we're all reading it wrong.
Yeah.
It is one word, but maybe we're reading it wrong. You know, that would be a cool place to start having the conversation about your cruising, actually, because you just mentioned where you are now, because you've been quite a lot of places. Like you've actually done quite a lot of sailing or motoring around. But how many miles have you done, do you think, since you first got that boat and started working on it?
So I've had the boat since the beginning of 2017, so a pretty long time. And since then, we've come from Panama up until the Sea of Cortez. But we basically, getting from Panama to the southern Mexico, we did fairly quickly. And then we got stuck doing a 3-year refit. And then we went from Southern Mexico to the Sea of Cortez quickly again. So the sailing we've done has been kind of quick, but we've also been stuck in places for prolonged periods. But gosh, we must have done like maybe 2,000 nautical miles or something like that. It's a pretty long coastline. Like, Central America is funny because you can, you know, you go to like a country every day just about if you want to, because the coastline's pretty short. And then you get to Mexico and you're like, oh, it's like 3 days
forever
everywhere. Yeah, so
it's, just keeps on going and going and going.
Yeah.
I suppose, That's it's a cool story in terms of like your learning process, because you got like an aluminium boat, which like by even an experienced, you know, boat owner standards is something that takes a lot of intricacy to refit as well as maintain, but like making sure, you know, your paints are right and your seals are right and you're going to get electrolysis on stuff. It's a lot. Like you jumped in at the deep end, eh, when you got that thing.
Yeah. I always kind of joke that I like the boat chose me and not the other way around, because my ex-husband was the one who picked the boat, and then I moved on board and started doing the veterinary work. And then when we split up, he kind of like left the boat with me basically. So I kind of ended up buying the boat out, even though I wasn't 100% sure that that was the right decision. And at that stage, she was in like pretty bad condition, because we'd had her for about a year, but she had like, at that stage, my engine didn't work. My shaft seal was also just constantly leaking to the point we just had to tie bags around the outside of the propeller to stop water coming in just constantly. And then like the sails were ripped. I had no life raft. Everything was falling apart. We had basically pretty much holes in the boat from electrolysis. She had no anodes. And it was definitely, I was kind of the vet girl and he was the boat guy. And so then I had to transition from being the vet to also being the boat person and the captain. And, you know, it was a really big learning curve. I definitely had Nigel Kelder's books out a lot, but
Useful.
They're good. They're really good Bibles, but they don't cover much about aluminium boats. So then, of course, I had to do a lot of like self-research on just the, like you said, the intricacies of like owning an aluminium boat and how to track stray currents and why we were getting such bad electrolysis. And so the refit, you know, it was meant to be, we kind of thought it would maybe be like 3 to 6 months. And then 3 years later, we were like, all right, we finally finished.
You know, I've heard people like underestimate refits, but I think that's the biggest one I've ever heard, actually.
I know.
3 months to 3 years.
Yeah.
But totally transformed the boat.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And she was, you know, we had a lot of people kind of say to us like, oh, you should just sell and get a new boat. And I was like, yeah, but like nobody wants to buy a boat with holes in it. And, you know, like we were at that point where we would have been selling it for nothing, which means we would have had nothing to invest in a new boat and would have been in the same position with just a different, you know, different boat. So at that point, my new partner had sailed from Costa Rica with me to Mexico, and he was invested in the boat too and, you know, wanted to keep going. So, yeah, we decided to just put in the hard yards. And, basically we had, I think, 12 plates welded over holes in it. And we had to redo all of the water tanks for aluminium, and they were just severely corroded, so we had to redo all that. We did a bunch of work, and then we splashed after 2 years, tried to leave, and got halfway across the Gulf of the Tehuantepec, where there's some really crazy winds that come across, and our old engine just, the transmission gave out. So basically the problem with the Tehuantepec is, the Gulf of the Tehuantepec is, you have to cross when there's no wind, because you either have 80 knot winds or no wind. So we were crossing in a window where we had, you know, 5 days of no wind, but then our engine died, and we'd sailed for 80, was it about 80, 100 nautical miles roughly, you know, into the middle of the Gulf of the Tehuantepec, and then had to turn around and go back. And it took us 4 days to go like 80 nautical miles, because there was so little wind. We had no engine. We were just like bobbing around in 8-foot swell. It was so awful. So
the worst.
Yeah. So we decided then to just repower. It was during COVID, so people kind of weren't able to do a lot anyway. And we were just like, you know what, we've done all this work on the boat, and every time we start the engine, we're wondering, is it going to start? When is the next time it's going to conk out on us? You know, so
Yeah, it's not nice, that feeling.
No, it added another year in the boatyard because it took so long to get in with COVID. Everything was really behind on ordering engines.
Took
So,
like a year to get an engine. Flipping out.
yeah, well, it took about 6 months to get an engine, and I just happened to break my leg skiing while we were waiting for it. So then that added a bit of extra time out of the
Just
boatyard. So it
I'll show
was one of
you who's
those.
with me because I know you love animals.
Oh, hello. Oh, so cute.
This is one of the we rescue cats. Well, we used to a lot. We don't anymore. But that was
So
one of our
cute.
rescues.
What's her name or his name?
Her name's
She's
Queen
cute.
Elizabeth III.
Oh, that's a good name.
Yeah, she's not going to make it to the monarchy. We know that. But she's precious and wonderful. So
Yeah, I'm sure
I would
she's the
call her
queen of
Queen
the boat at
Elizabeth.
least. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. Sorry, I interrupted you there. I just thought
No,
you'd
that's
like
all
to see
right.
my cat.
No, she's beautiful. Yeah, so
Yeah.
that's we had kind of a bit of a year of unfortunate events that made the engine saga just take a lot longer than expected. But yeah, we finally got out of there, and since then have been cruising again with some speed and actually seeing places, and it's been
Yeah.
nice to kind of be back on the water again.
What do you think was the biggest challenge during that refit? Like not mentally, because like being in a yard for 3 years is obviously like a heavy mental exercise. But like in terms of probably physically and like emotionally managing a specific project, because you did a lot, like it was a lot that you did.
Yeah, no, we pretty much redid the whole boat, and I think a big thing was the heat, because Puerto Madero in southern Mexico, it's like pretty much 30 degrees year round. It's just always hot with like 60 to 80% humidity, like depending on the time of year. It's really hot, really humid. Sometimes like it will just rain for a week, that kind of thing. So that was kind of a really hard physical part of it, was just the heat. We eventually, like the first kind of 3, 4 months, we were, doing the whole get there at 7 a.m., work till 5 p.m. every day. And
Can't
then we
do
were getting, yeah, we got so burnt
that.
out.
Need those siestas.
So we started embracing siesta culture, which made a really big difference. And the other really hard thing is, we were in a pretty rural area of Mexico, and we were living in a very small town. It's a slightly impoverished town, just outside of Chiapas. And so the infrastructure in the town isn't so great. And we actually got typhoid fever while we were there. And we got really, really sick for about a month. And that was physically really difficult too. Up until that point, I'd been a vegetarian for like 7 years or so, but I lost like, I was down to like 95 pounds or something, like 40
Holy
kilos.
cow,
I was really
that's
little.
nothing.
Yeah. So no, we'd lost so much weight being so sick, and it'd taken a while to get diagnosed because we were in like a very small town. And luckily the doctors have treated it a lot of times because it's unfortunately quite common in that town. So
Oh, no.
a lot of the children get it. So they knew what to do, but it just took us so long to get better. So I actually gave up on my vegetarianism for a period of time so that I could get some
That
weight
was a
back
great
on me and
sacrifice.
stuff.
7 years you didn't eat a piece of meat.
No, I'd been eating fish since
Oh.
I'd lived on the boat for the couple years previously. Just if we
That's
caught fish,
different.
I ate it. Yeah, but I hadn't eaten anything else. I still only eat chicken and fish, but yeah, the smell of chicken just was driving me crazy. And I was like, I think my body's trying to tell me something.
Is that what you
Like,
went
so
for? Chicken. You broke it with chicken. Was it good?
yeah, they do this roast chicken down there where they just like have a like wood fire, and they just have like 10 rotisserie chickens going, and they, I don't know
Yeah.
what they put on it, but it's fatty and delicious and salty. And yeah, that broke my
You don't sound like a
sentiment.
vegetarian.
No,
Oh
not anymore.
yeah,
I know,
it's
once I
like you.
started again.
Then you just KFC every week from
I
now.
know, yeah.
Okay. I
So
expect you
yeah,
to
so
get
there
a
was,
tear in your eye. I had to eat a chicken. It was
yeah.
horrible.
No, it was definitely like a weird, unexpected turn of events with that, but definitely there was like some weird physical things like that, and that we kind of
Well,
had
your
to
body
overcome
chemistry
while doing the
changes when you
refit.
get that, like everything.
Oh yeah, it was a really long recovery. I think it was a good 6 months before, because we obviously had to take like a ton of different antibiotics, and then it turned out we not only had typhoid, but I also had an amoeba, and my partner had an amoeba and a large intestinal worm. So we'd somehow picked up. I mean, we work with like in rural communities with dogs and cats, so it's somewhat
Oh,
not
yeah.
surprising. We've probably exposed ourselves to some strange things. But yeah, it took us a good 6 months, I think, after like the antibiotics, anti-parasite medicine, you know, all that stuff to get everything kind of back to normal. So that was a big challenge. Yeah.
Because like antibiotics, they take a lot out of, like, if you're on antibiotics for like an extended period of time and you're taking other chemical, you know, treatments as well, like that would really mess your body up.
Yeah. No, I think our gut flora was really destroyed from it for a while there. So, we were very lucky. There was actually a really nice cruiser in the marina we were at who used to be a doctor. And she had actually done part of her training in Mexico. So was quite aware of some of these diseases that maybe aren't as common, you know, in the global north and in the United States and things, but she kind of knew about treating them. So she was really helpful just with our recovery period, kind of helping us like, you guys need to get some probiotics and like take a omeprazole and do all these things to just help our kind of gastrointestinal systems get back on track after, you know, killing all the bugs. So,
Yeah. Well, all the good stuff as well, like that stuff.
Exactly.
Gut health is now just something which is very big on social media. Like, it's never really spoke about before, but we've got like a lot of it in our family. People who are just like, you know, not losing weight, eating and feeling terrible constantly, not digesting food like at all. And like the stomach enzymes is something that's not really spoke about when you go to a doctor. Like, oh, what are your stomach enzymes like? Oh, it's so important.
Yeah. And they've definitely demonstrated now too a lot of, you know, link between gastrointestinal health and mental health and things as well, where, you know, if your gut biome's really messed up, it can cause all these other things. And so I think we definitely kind of had that experience as well. Like you said, it's hard. Being on the hard can be pretty like soul draining anyway, but then we were on the hard and we were sick and we were losing weight and then we, you know, we're on all these antibiotics. It was definitely like a rough period of time for us to kind of really be like, are we doing the right thing being here? But you know, we get through it.
I get it. You know, like there's some moments in the boatyard where you just reach new lows, but I think I've never reached a low where like I look in the toilet and I'm like, oh my God, I've got worms. Like that's a pretty low one for boatyard life, isn't it?
For sure, for sure.
I've not heard that one before.
No, definitely.
So what engine did you decide to repower with?
So we actually ended up going with the exact same one. So we had a Yanmar 3YM30 and we ended up just replacing it with the same one. Oh, mostly nice. Because the boat's aluminium, all of the, you know, all the engine mounts, everything's like built into the hull kind of thing. So whenever you try and change anything structurally, you're not just, you know, like building some fiberglass or cutting something away and, you know, you're kind of welding and cutting metals and things like that. So we really wanted to guarantee that the engine was going to fit in our engine compartment and not have to do any modifications. So we basically decided to stick with the same one. And we're so far really happy with it. We've we had some fuel issues when we first put it in. It wasn't the Yanmar itself. It was the like us getting the fuel to it. As it turned out, it was the brake oil. But it took us a really long time to figure out. We think, we still don't know for sure. We basically replaced all the lines and the fuel filters and then everything started working again. But it took us a couple months to figure that out as well, because it was taking about 10 hours for the engine to fail from fuel delivery. So it was this thing where like we'd change one thing, then we would take it out for a test and it would be fine. We're like, okay, cool. And then we'd take it for a longer test. And then all of a sudden, you know, 10 hours into a trip, then it would conk out. And it was happening like really intermittently. So it's possible we may have had like a crack in a hose or a hose clamp issue that was only happening in certain like conditions as well. We're not 100% sure, but you know, we just repowered, and after a couple months of like messing around and replacing one thing and then seeing and one thing and then seeing, we were like, you know what, we spent like all this money on a new engine. Let's just spend the $300 and get a new rake or filter, new, you know, new pipes, new hose clamps, all that, and just hopefully be done with it. And thankfully so far she's done another, I don't know, 300 hours and hasn't had any issues. So we should be good.
Nice. You know, it must be bliss. You know, just heading out to the ocean and just being like, I've got like 400 hours on my engine. I've got no issues.
Yeah.
I've got like 6,000 on mine. It's not a worry. It's a Volvo, the good engines, but I'm always like, it's done a few, you know?
No, for sure. And that was, we really had like engine PTSD where we would like, even with the new one, like, you know, we go to press the start button and we kind of like look at each other before we press it.
Breath.
And then, yeah. And now it's slowly fading, but even now still, it's kind of like, is it going to start? But Yeah, it always starts. So it's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, that's wicked. That's really cool. Right. Onto your the work that you do, which I would imagine is probably the most important thing in your life, because it seems like it. Because I watched your sailing videos from years ago, actually. I like to watch the channels that save animals, because that's what we used to. And then there was you on your boat, and then there was an Aussie couple called he's Aussie, called Ryan, and she's Canadian, it's called Brittany. I actually ended up crossing an ocean with them. But they also like rescue animals. They're not a vet like you are, but they rescue loads of dogs and cats all over the place. That was obviously your thing before you started sailing around. But what made you think that you could do that whilst traveling, living on a boat? So it's very different.
Yeah. Honestly, I pretty much just kind of, I didn't really know if it would work or not. And I just kind of started doing it and then let it shape itself as things kind of unraveled, because I had been working in, I'd kind of gotten a bit disillusioned with the normal veterinary clinic, veterinary industry, because I felt like I was not able to give the best treatment to the animals based on what their owners could afford. So we would sometimes have like a little puppy come in. It had, say, been hit by a car and had like two broken legs, something that was going to cost, you know, $5,000, $10,000. And the owners, for, you know, for, there's so many reasons people don't have $10,000 on hand in any given moment.
Yeah,
you know, it's not a matter of neglect. It's just a matter of like who has 10 grand these days. And so, you know, so people couldn't afford it. And then we'd be euthanizing this family's puppy just because of kind of a bad luck where it had been hit by a car, like completely out of their hands, you know, things like that. And so I kind of started to get pretty disillusioned with the fact that that's kind of how the industry is. And I understand why, because obviously it's a business and people have to get paid and, you know, things cost money, but it was just hard for me to make those decisions. And so I started working for charities pretty early on in my career. And I had been working basically rescuing bears from bile farms in China with a large organization called Animals Asia. And I guess that really opened my eyes to kind of the type of work that could be done, where our CEO, Jill, had basically just saw these bears when she was on kind of a tourist trip in China and was like, I'm going to do something about this. And she just kind of started small and then opened this bear rescue center. And now it's, you know, they've helped end bear bile farming in Vietnam, and they're helping to end it in China, and have done a lot of really amazing things. And so I also was doing outreach with the dogs and cats locally in the area as well. And so I kind of was like, I really like doing this, where I just kind of can go to people and help how they need it, instead of necessarily having this big plan. So it was my partner who really wanted a boat. I had literally zero sailing experience. I'd never been on a sailboat until I'd been on Chuffed, so I really was going in blind in that regard, but I had the experience working with animals in remote places and things like that. So I basically the boat was in Panama City, and I just started reaching out to different animal organizations and kind of being like, I'd worked with wildlife as well quite a lot, so I reached out to wildlife sanctuaries and did some training with them, and then I reached out to a spay and neuter place and kind of said, look, we're going to be going to these remote islands. I'd love to like do some spay and neuter there if it's something you'd be interested in helping with. And so they kind of just helped me set up those first clinics, where they let me know, you know, I did some training with their vets in some rural areas, learned how they did it all, learned what equipment I might need, and then just went out and kind of started doing it. And basically in every new country, I kind of just do that, where I send feelers out to local veterinarians and organizations, get a bit of an idea of the needs, and then just kind of let it unfold somewhat organically, I guess, based on kind of how it all goes when we're there. Because it's not always easy to plan too far in advance with that kind of work, because it's really dependent on the location and what's there and the animals and all kind, you know, things like that. So,
that's really good that you I mean, like, obviously, it's like you said, you know, vets is a business. It's never, you know, you don't really get like, you know, state funded veterinary clinics.
No,
I think you should. No, it's great that you saw. I won't say it's a bad side of the industry. It's just the way I think some vets charge insane prices.
Yes,
like one of our cats has got like the hip that was popping out a while back, And yeah, we took him to a couple of the vets, and they were like, it's going to cost like €7,000 or €5,000. And we were like, that's like, you know, a lot of money. Unless you're a super wealthy person, I suppose it's a lot. And then we managed to find like some guy who was in, I think he was teaching university students or something. And he was like, yeah, you know, we'll use your cat as like a university,
article.
I don't know, program or something like
training.
That.
Training. So
training. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that basically saved that cat's life, actually. So yeah, it was really worth it. But yeah, like it's cool that you saw that and you decided to actually go and do something about it. So a lot of people, like, you know, they're aware of stuff that goes on within their industry or their work profession, but they very rarely actually go to change it. And then you like really committed a large portion of your life to it as well, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm just very, I feel very passionately about like the relationship people have with their pets. I think anybody who's had a pet is aware of like what they can bring to a family, into your life, into individuals. And I don't think that socioeconomic status should be a barrier to people being able to love their pets. And I do think there's a lot of like judgment surrounding that too, where even in the veterinary industry, you know, people say the things like, oh, well, if you can't afford to have your pet, you shouldn't have one. And I don't completely believe that, because I think there's a lot of people who deserve to love a pet and have a pet. Like, you know, a child from an impoverished area still deserves to have a dog to play with and to love and to have that experience. And it's not their fault that they don't have, you know, the funding to do all the veterinary care that might be needed. So I'm very passionate about, you know, every child or every person deserves the love of a pet, and every pet deserves to get healthcare. And so, you know, delivering that healthcare to areas where it's needed is kind of a really big thing for us. And also then we also try and work on that kind of one health policy where, you know, there's children in Mexico who have died from Rocky Mountain fever, which is transmitted from the dogs through a bite of a tick to the kids. And so, you know, by treating the dogs with any tick products and flea and tick medicine, we're hopefully also then preventing that from spreading to children. And, you know, it's all, everybody's health is connected. And when you help the health of like dogs in, you know, in need communities, you're also helping the community health and the wildlife health. And then that can help improve the health of the whole country. You know, obviously what we're doing is smaller than that, but hopefully has those ripple effects and can make a difference, you know, on a bigger scale. So yeah.
No, it's everything comes from one moment, doesn't it? So,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
it
exactly.
makes complete sense. So when you boil it down to the details, you're saving the world.
Hopefully, yeah, one dog at a time.
One dog at a time, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, as you've gone through your travels, I've watched like some of the stuff you've done, and you've saved like some pretty exotic animals as well. It's not just dogs and cats. I've seen you do like surgeries on turtles, big turtles, actually. What is the wildest surgery you've ever done on like a big exotic type of creature out there?
Pre sailing, I did once have to do a hernia repair that had a piece of intestine in it that had become strangulated in a polar bear, which was pretty cool.
No way.
So that's like kind of my coolest vet story that I get to throw around sometimes.
You removed a hernia from a polar bear.
Yeah. He was a polar bear that was in a zoo, and he had basically had this little umbilical hernia, and then one day it got really big, and the zoo contacted us because we were doing so much bear work. And we went and removed a piece of his intestine and saved him, which was really cool. He was gigantic, and I had to, because they didn't have a lot of facilities, I had to do the surgery. He was too big to move anywhere because he was like 600 kilos. So I ended up doing the surgery like on the floor. So we had to like lay out surgical mats all on the floor and then cover him in surgical mats. And, you know, there's a photo of me with his arms kind of around my body because we had to lay him out on his back. And he's just massive, like the biggest animal I've ever been near. But so that was a very cool story. But
that's great. You should intro yourself with that.
Yeah, I know.
From a polar bear. Hello.
That's actually
that's a great story.
That's how I introduced myself to my current boyfriend, pretty much. So that's, I think, how I got
that
here.
Would win. That would be a winner, I'd have to say. That would be a very good tagline. Yeah.
Yeah. But since being on Chuffed, we have done our wildlife work as well. Titi was a turtle we recently rescued, and she was kind of cool just because, again, she was a really big sea turtle, and we think she was probably around 60 years of age, which means she was breeding. She's also what they call a black sea turtle, which is a Pacific green sea turtle, kind of maybe a green, maybe a black. There's some controversy around that, but she had
politics involved there.
Yes, yeah, exactly, science. But we think she had a red tide toxicity, so that was kind of a special one, just because the La Cruz Marina in near Puerto Vallarta, they actually gave us permission to do her treatments on the dock. So this one of the security guards went and found us a pool at one of the fishing places and brought that for us to the dock, helped us fill it with water. We kind of ended up with the whole like cruising community there involved in her like day-to-day care and what was happening with her. And so that was just kind of a really nice one because there were so many people involved. But I was very lucky in Costa Rica to also work with a lot of wildlife, and in Panama. So we worked with sloths. I castrated a kinkajou, which is a pretty strange little possum-like animal. Yeah, they're called kinkajous.
Possum-like animal.
Cute. Yes, yeah, they're very cute little nocturnal.
Kinkajou
things.
Sounds like a type of Pokemon. That sounds
lovely. Yeah, yeah. He kind of looks like a little Pokemon. He's very cute.
Right, okay.
We had a baby sloth that was in care, and he had some like colic gas problems. So we had to give him little like belly massages every day. So it was pretty fun. Yeah, little baby sloth. So I've got to do a lot of really cool stuff like that, which is, you know, another really nice thing about kind of traveling and working for free is that everybody can use my help because it's not, you know, I'm not charging for it. And so I've also got to experience a lot of really cool opportunities that a lot of vets, I guess, don't always get to have. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one to move on to, actually. So like funding your travels and all that. Do you still work and earn money, or you're retired, and like, do you raise money for the animals that you save, or do you give donations to different clinics? Like, what do you do with all that side of stuff?
Yeah, so basically, we are pretty much funded entirely through our patrons. So, we have the monthly patrons that give to us, and that kind of gives us the base to know what we're able to do each month. But then we will do specific fundraisers for, like, we just recently visited 6 villages in the Sea of Cortez and delivered vaccinations to them all, because a lot of them are boat access only. So for those 60 vaccines, we worked out how much the vaccines were going to cost and how much the flea and tick medicine was going to cost, and did like a specific smaller fundraiser just to fund all of that. Because as you know, on a boat, there's so many expenses in terms of just the diesel and the fuel, and like getting to a place can be expensive as well. So we tend to use kind of our patronage to fund and fuel the boat moving and the filming. And then we do specific fundraisers for like specific animals that need treatment. But it's definitely not a way to, I guess, become a millionaire. It's we don't really make money. Yes. So we as individuals don't really make money doing what we do, but we're able to live off of it. So essentially we're kind of just, you know, like our food is paid for. We obviously live on the boat, and so we have accommodation. We are hoping that one day as we grow, we can eventually make it a little more sustainable, where we can pay ourselves like a base wage, that just so that, you know, we are in our 30s, and obviously as much as we're not like big money people, you need some savings at some point in your life. Yeah. So we'll, we're too young to retire. Somewhere. I also work when I visit my family in Australia. I tend to locum for a couple months as well, just to kind of boost that, you know, income up a little bit each year. So yeah, so we've definitely kind of sacrificed that side of things a little bit doing what we do, in terms of like earning a good income. But we also then obviously have the freedom of, you know, choosing our work hours, and we, you know, get to sail and make videos as well as do family
work. Saving
the
world,
the harder stuff. Yeah, so it's definitely worth it.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
And okay, so that's what you do for like earning a living and all that type of stuff. Mate, honestly, I think you should send like National Geographic an email, or whatever that company is in America that do like documentaries on like truckers. like ice truckers.
Oh, yeah.
You know the channel? I'm sure it's National Geographic. Like, like the traveling vets. Like, honestly, email them.
Yeah, we have been contacted a couple times by producers who want to do something, but then it always just kind of like peters out. So I assume they just don't get the funding off the ground or something. I don't know. I don't know that
if you,
industry
honestly,
very
if you're
well.
Traveling around the world on a boat and if you're saving like cute furry animals, I mean, I'm a bit biased because I love cute furry animals. I have them everywhere.
there's got to be a market, right?
There's got to be, yeah. There's a massive subsector of TikTok that's just like people showing you videos of cute furry animals.
Yeah.
There'd be a big audience, I'm sure.
Yeah, I have to admit I'm not on TikTok. Maybe that's what we're missing. So
no, we're not missing.
Good.
There's not missing anything there. My wife goes on it at night because we just think it's hilarious. It's just conspiracy theories, the whole thing, but not stuff which is kind of believable. Like if they were saying, "Oh, the CIA does this or MI5 does that," you'd be like, "Well, maybe." But it's like these people are like, "Oh, a star has moved in the sky. You know, that means that the entire world is going to shift to a different parallel universe tomorrow." And they're delivering it with such, intensity. Like, you have to believe them.
I know. I had a friend send me one that was about Australia not being real. And she just sent it to me saying, "Are you sure you're real?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure."
I don't know.
Apparently, not being real. Yeah, apparently all Australians are British paid actors who pretend to be from Australia. So, yeah.
Who knows? We may never know the truth about that one. it is a bit crazy. No, don't download that one. You're not missing out.
Yeah, okay, good. I'll stay on.
So you're in, did you say New Jersey? You're in New Jersey now.
Yeah, we're in New Jersey at the moment. Where
is that where your fella's from?
Yeah. So he's from New Jersey.
Cool.
So we're basically here waiting for Jim to get, he developed an arrhythmia last year and we're just waiting for him to be able to get a cardiac ablation done and then we can go back to the boat. So that way he won't have to, right now he's taking medicine and it's very well managed, but you know, finding medicine in rural areas of Mexico and things isn't always that fun. And we'd rather know that he'll never get it again rather than have it come up again while we're, you know, 5 days out at sea somewhere. So getting all that sorted. And then we'll be able to head back to Chuff. So she's on the hard right now in San Carlos. Yeah.
Nice. Very cool. So you've visited some family a little bit and your fella's getting some medical stuff done. And then what's the plan for when you get back on the boat, do you think?
So we luckily don't have too much to do before splashing this time. We are repainting the bottom. We have ablative antifoul and it unfortunately has not held up super well. I don't think it's like a brand thing. It sounds like it just ablative antifoul just isn't that great. But you know, it's what you need on an aluminium boat. So so we just got to redo the bottom paint and then we're pretty much ready to splash. We're debating some rigging stuff. Our furler is kind of trying to die. But it feels a bit like Pandora's box because the rigging is the one thing we didn't do in the refit. And so, you know, it's like if we do the furler, should we look at all the rigging? And then once you start looking at all the rigging, you know,
expensive
Pandora's box could open. Yeah. So we definitely need a new furler. And we're just kind of trying to decide how much we want to do on that, how quickly and when we want to do it. But that may be on the agenda at some point. But otherwise,
there's loads of boatyards in the States. I'd imagine around New Jersey as well.
Yeah, we might be able to. That would be, we've got new sails, so we want to try and get the same one so that the sail slide, because it's a, I can't remember what millimeter it is, but it's not a very common size. We want to try and make sure that obviously it fits into the track. But I think there's ways ways around that. But yeah, but it's a pro furl. They're everywhere, so I'm sure we'll be able to find one.
Oh, gosh, they're on so many boats as standard.
Yeah, so I think we should be able to figure that out pretty easily. And then, then basically we're hoping to kind of do a similar thing to what we were doing this last couple months where we basically are visiting boat access or remote communities in the Sea of Cortez and doing, depending on, we're kind of doing it now where we do like a bit of an expedition, an exploration first, where we go to the communities first and kind of find out like how many dogs there are, get some local contacts, find out, you know, are the dogs spayed and neutered? Do they need to be spayed and neutered? Do they need vaccines? Like kind of get an idea for the needs of that individual community. And then we kind of restock and go back with everything. So that's kind of what we'd like to keep doing in the Sea of Cortez. And we're also looking into trying to help at some more wildlife places. There's not as much wildlife hospitals and things set up in Mexico. But there are marine biology rescue centers for like turtles and marine mammals and things. So we're looking at trying to work with some of those people as well while we're in the Sea of Cortez, since it's such a diverse marine area. It'd be kind of cool to get involved with that as well.
Yeah, that would be great. When it comes to like doing the work on the animals, is there any type of animal that you haven't worked on, or fish or mammal, whatever, that you'd really like to do?
Yeah, I haven't done much work with marine mammals. I've done some kind of courses on it. And given that we live on a boat, I think everyone expects me to be a dolphin vet. But no, I haven't had that chance. I'd really love to, dolphin vet. Yeah, that would be cool. So I'd really like to be able to do some of that. So Mexico is a kind of good place. They have some very good marine vets there. So hopefully we can kind of dive into that a little bit here and there. And I do really like working with the turtles as well. I have had the opportunity to do that a bit, but I really do like working with sea turtles. So it'd be nice to do a little more of that as well. Yeah.
So cute. Have you ever been tempted to put like a little bandana around one when you in operation, maybe giving him some ninja equipment?
Yeah. That would be cute.
I'd do that.
Yeah. We could probably do it post-production maybe on something.
Yeah. I wonder if there's laws against that, taking advantage of sleeping animals. I don't know.
You know, Costa Rica has very strict laws about that, actually. They
I can't dress turtles as ninjas.
They have very strict exploitation rules, where even filming wildlife, like, we had to be very careful.
You know what?
Yeah, what we filmed, it just has to, like, you're allowed to film medical procedures and things, but it has to be like, there's a very fine line between filming it to raise money for animals and to help animals versus filming it for like exploitive purposes. So, which is good. I mean, they've
poaching
got some,
maybe or something.
Yes. Yeah. I think they're worried about poaching. And they're very strict about, something that happens in a lot of countries is people with good intentions, but with not very much knowledge, open these wildlife rescue centers. And then they end up with, 40 monkeys with all these problems, and they aren't veterinarians. They don't have any funding, and, things can turn kind of pear-shaped pretty quickly. So I think Costa Rica tries to avoid that. Yeah. And also personal collections that are under the name of a sanctuary, but it's actually somebody just collecting animals, which happens. Yeah. So,
right. Okay. Yeah. Right. Fair enough.
It's a wild world out there.
Yeah. It's quite crazy. You have to let your imagination run wild, don't you?
Definitely.
What the possibilities are there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really cool. Have you got any, cruising, I suppose, bucket list places that you want to go to? Like, where would you love to go over to Asia and maybe do some more work on bears over there from the boat?
Yeah, I would really love to do, like, Indonesia looks really amazing. There's as a veterinarian, there's so much in Indonesia. Like, I've done a little bit of work with small primates, but that I would love to do work with orangutans and things like that. So there's some very cool things over there. And it also just looks like amazing cruising grounds. I would also love to get the boat to the Galapagos at some point, because again, there's some very cool wildlife there, and it's also meant to be pretty amazing cruising grounds. But the Galapagos sounds like there's a lot of red tape paperwork with going there, but yeah, maybe one day. So. But no, definitely Asia looks really, really cool. We'd love to hang out in Indo for a little bit, I think.
Oh, that's wicked. And you've been nominated for Most Inspirational Cruiser at the Cruisers Awards. I voted for you because of the
work. Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
No, I think it's very cool. Well, listen, good luck with all of that.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see what else you do and which other animals you save. And please continue saving the world. It's very appreciated.
I will do. Thanks for asking us questions and having us. It's been cool to chat.